Accession number 20457, reel 31.
Brigadier Randall, reel 30. Reel 31. Then you handed over when you got back to Ireland.
We knew that Othello knew it was going to Germany, and therefore they were beginning to build the strength up, because it was going to be an APC battalion, I think, of certainly three, if not four. So they certainly had to build up a third company and a strong support weapons company. So about the time I handed over, we were being built up.
How was that done? Was it, were they just bringing in regular drafts of recruits?
Well, I think as each output went out of the Wessex Brigade depot, we got a higher proportion of the chaps. See, we'd always had recruiting quite well. The sad thing was that in the days when we were low priority, chaps who were Devon chaps and Dorset chaps were joining the army, but being sent off to the Duke of Edinburgh's or to the Gloucesters or the Hampshires or something like that. And that's the way the system worked. Yeah. So what it meant was that we were getting a higher proportion of this output, but still mostly chaps from our own regimental county area.
And your next post, I think you said that you were in the military sectors department.
Yeah, back in the military sectors department. This was at head office, of course. Mm.
And you were now in the MOD rather than the War Office, but you'd served in the War Office before,
yeah.
I think. How did the MOD compare to the War Office as a place to work?
Well, I was out of Stanmore, you see.
Yes.
And again, MS is a sort of world on its own, really.
Ah.
If you're working in a sort of an ordinary MS work, you have to. It's a whole question of meeting up with people and minuting people and endless meetings. You've got to bring the financiers in and the PR view. But MS worked on its own. You didn't have to bring anybody in. I was in the branch which dealt with the promotions of everybody up from major to lieutenant colonel to colonel, and colonel to brigadier, and also the appointment of all commanding officers of regiments or battalions. That was my branch was responsible for. So apart from liaison with colonels of regiments and with the personnel branches, one lived in more or less sort of cocooned or isolated from the main sort of stream of MOD work. Well, I went up twice or sometimes three times a week, because the selection boards were always held in the selection board room in the main office next door to the military sector's office. So one spent half one's time in London, in the MOD, but with office and records and all that sort of all the work was done back at Stanmore.
How were these selection boards constituted?
Well, they were numbered in those days, 1, 2, 3, those are the three main boards. One board was Brigadier. No, one board was Major Generals and above. Two board was Brigadier and Colonels and Lieutenant Colonels appointments. And three board was promotions.
Who actually sat on them and how were they chosen?
Well, they had various. Number two board, Director of Army Staff Duties, was always the chairman. And then you had a set of officers who were there by ex officio.
Mm. What sort of considerations were brought up when you were considering them?
Well, the whole system went through a change when I was there, a fundamental change. See, up to about 1965, 66, MS had to. Appointment came out, and MS more or less ran chaps for the job. When I was selected to see it, I was a major, and if my regiment said they wanted Major Randall, and there was I was at the right age, I wasn't a sort of 30-year-old or 45-year-old, and there was nothing in my record against it. I got promoted, which is fine in my case, but at the end of the day, and this happened throughout the army, it left too much power of patronage in the hands of military secretary's branch. There's no doubt about that. I'm not saying it was abused at all, but the fact is that so the army adjutant general introduced it. It was done by the director of Manning. They turned the other thing round. They said, in future, there will be a grading system, and every officer's majors will enter a promotion zone, and they will remain in that zone till they're either promoted or they eventually leave it unpromoted. There will be so many vacancies in each arm, in each group, and all the confidential reports of all the officers in that zone will go before the selection board, and they will have to read through them. And they will mark people, and then those who come out at the top get the vacancy.
That sounds like it's a very laborious and time-consuming process.
Well, this is the theory. I have to say that, though I was an MS at the time and bitterly resented, I looking back at it now, I think it was the right business. The trouble was that when it came to major to lieutenant colonel, these people weren't permanent selection board members. They were busy chaps, the system had to be an air. So you had preliminary boards chaired by brigadiers to weed out people. I mean, if a chap was in the zone, but he'd been over years described as a very indifferent officer, below average, well, then you didn't bother to put him forward. And records were kept, so if anybody challenged this, someone could say, well, this is it. So they then weeded it down to reasonable, but it did involve a lot more work, and the generals on the selection boards had to do work a great deal harder and take more trouble than when the military secretary's branch virtually did it for them. I'm not saying that at the end of the day it probably didn't produce very much the same result, but it was clearly fairer and could be seen to be fairer. Mm. There was always suspicion that the MS fixed it. And of course you could, if you were unscrupulous. There's no doubt about it, you could fix an officer, there's no doubt about that at all. I never did. There are a few officers around who I pushed because I thought they'd been badly handled, and they got their promotion largely through my efforts. But I did a few chaps a good turn, but I never did anybody down. That would be beneath my contempt to abuse one's position. But perhaps I was a bit naughty to push one. But I happen to know these chaps had bad luck. Anyway.
Was your work mainly in administration of these boards and their decisions, or were you actually in the decision-making process yourself?
Well, we had to do all the preparation. We had to get all the officers together, make out the lists,
the brigadier, I had a brigadier, he was sometimes away, and you had to go down and produce the... There was a selection board, five major generals or six major generals on the other side of the table, and then you had to produce all the lists, answer any questions, make sure that the things get right. And then sometimes there would be an argument, there'd be one vacancy, and they would ask MS any questions about it. Mm. But there was a summary of every officer's career on a piece of paper which we produced. And then we then had to... publish them.
Yes.
The pink list was always known as the pink minutes of number three board was always on pink paper. and then promotion to colonel were on green, and then promotion to major brigadier was on yellow paper. So the jargon of the, you heard the pink list, I expect.
Yes.
The blue list and the...
I've been pink listed is the current phrase.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Well, that's how it happened, simply because we always, minutes of those meetings, always typed on pink paper. Well, probably isn't now, because we don't go in for radio paper now.
No. What sort of things were you looking for in potential battalion commanders?
That was promotion.
The critical step, really, is that step, isn't it, between major to lieutenant colonel.
But then, you see, that was a step. But then I also had to do all command appointments. Mm. Well, in the infantry, of course, we would let the colonel of the regiment and the brigade colonel, divisional brigadier, as it were, say, well, these are the people of your division who are on the pink list. Mm. And, of course, he could take into consideration those who were in the age group for command in previous years, who some of them were on staff job. So anyway, he would have a full list, and then we would like nominations from you for command of the first work for the Argyll Southern Highlanders coming up in May. Mm. So they would then produce recommendations. They would go to the director of infantry, who would put in his. They'd go to the personnel branch, in that case, infantry AAG2, and they would all put in a. Views or no, and then you would then have this big command thing. You have the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, a sheet of paper when it's due, and then you'd have the following officers listed, all those in the zone, and then you would have a right-hand column, strongly recommended by Colonel Regiment Director of Infantry, or sometimes there'd be a clash of view, or sometimes. One occasion, I remember, surprisingly, they said, well, I'll leave it, there were two officers, so the Colonel Redmond said, well, I'll leave it to the selection board. Mm. He was copying out. He could always say, well, in the end, I left it to the selection board. Oh. Mm. and then the same thing happened, but the gunners and stuff, and we did the lot. Mm. I was actually a member of the WRAC board. Well, because and the chaplains, they used to do it in such an extraordinary way that the military, they said a representative of the military secretary's branch. So I was actually on the board. There was one occasion when I marked a certain lady up, very, very high, it was like she got promotion. I never met her. Mm. But I remember as I left, I said, the rat brigadier said, sure, well, you're going off to have supper with your sweetie tonight. I said, Beth, I've never met her. But I went by the confidence report. But the chaplains were absolutely awful. I had to report them to the military secretary.
Why? Why were they awful?
Why were they awful? They'd go along and they wouldn't look at a confidence report. They all knew each other. They say, oh, so-and-so, he played rugby for Wales. Or he gave a jolly good sermon. I mean, they simply ignored it completely. So again, I went reporting this, and Mitchell sent me. I said, well, sir, I mean, I've been sent there to see the system, and I think this is what's going on. I said, I don't think it's in the spirit. And I think I ought to draw your attention to it. And he did, and he sent for the chaplain general and put him right, actually. Mm. To their credit, the chaplains didn't hold it against them.
They always had their regimental dinner after the day of all the selection boards. I remember some wag said, oh, because this is the feast of the pastor.
But it was fascinating work. I really enjoyed it, actually. They were dealing not directly with people, but you were dealing with human beings as opposed to sort of equipment and things. I enjoyed it. It was quite hard work, but you never got messed about. Well, with one exception, you never got a weekend. You never got so you. But you couldn't afford to make mistakes. That was the thing. Your staff worker had to be absolutely bang on. You know, if you got the wrong name or the wrong chap, then you would have been in big trouble.
Because careers were at stake.
Well, all sorts of things, you know. Yeah. So you had to. But I mean, they didn't. They didn't assert myself. They didn't sort of post rubbish there. So, I mean, I had the majors I had working under me were pretty switched on chaps. But yeah, you had to. But you had your staff work had to be absolutely spot on. But I enjoyed it. And of course, the great thing about military service is that they said, look, you're here to look after other people. Don't worry about yourself. We'll look after you. And in a sense, you do get looked, you're one of the boys.
So you're looked after well.
So you're not going to be sort of sent to the French Foreign Legion at the end of it.
You were sent off to something called Headquarters Army Strategic Command.
Yes.
What was that? What were you doing there? What were its functions?
Well, I think the army decided that they would break up to some extent the urban and the north south east west command, which had a, and they would retain some of those, but they would put all the operational troops in a separate command called Headquarters Strategic Command, which was based in the old Southern Command headquarters in Wilton. And then they would do away with the old Eastern Command and recall it Southern Command. And they'd do away with the old Western Command and incorporate that in Northern Command. So that, apart from the one or two battalions and the Brigade of Guards on public duties, all the fighting troops in Britain were in, from point of view of command and control, in Army Strategic Command, even though they were geographically based in other commands. And the idea was that because they were like that, the under one commander, the whole business of deploying them if necessary.
If you wanted to send a force, you wouldn't have to take a battery from Eastern Command and a Sapper Squadron from Western Command and a battalion from here. They were all under one command. And therefore, command and control for any operations abroad was much easier. And secondly, the standards of training and administration would be much more even.
So it was for flexibility, for rapidity of deployment overseas, and for standardisation of training standards.
This was it. It was bitterly resented by the
must have been bitterly other resented command by the
because
command.
They had people in their areas who were responsible for their sort of local discipline, obviously, but they didn't actually command them. But from point of view, I was the full colonel training there, which was a super job because it was, there were two divisions and a whole lot of troops. And training was the high priority. So,
training for what? What was the
main the various roles.
Yes,
I mean
What was seen as being the most important of those roles? What was your main your top priority?
Well, I mean, there was an air portable brigade, but I mean there were still potential troubles all over the world where British troops could be sent. I can't remember where they were, but we still had a presence in Bahrain and Oman and places like that. So the ops people had all sorts of plans, there was no particular place. Oh well, you'll go on this, but the brigade had to be ready in various degrees of notice. It was a standby battalion, as always had been, to deal with. So they had to be ready for air mobile operations anywhere. Mm. I also had a section of a lieutenant colonel and a major study sort of amphibious warfare. Mm. So we had to do that. that was.
There was something called the UK Mobile Force, wasn't there? At one
then there was
time.
The UK Mobile Force, which started. So there was a big operational requirement for training in ski training up in Norway.
Mm.
I also handled all the overseas exercises
all over the world. I mean, basically it was done in the MOD, but the actual allocation to units and the briefing of them and lessons learned, all that sort of thing went under my auspices. And then there was all the sort of normal training, sort of range areas and overall priorities.
Presumably this was
PTE, that's what it is.
So were you dealing with all aspects of training, from basic to advanced collective training?
Well, I mean the policy. Yes.
The policy.
Yes. Yeah, the policy was laid down in the MOD.
Mm-hmm.
But my main...
You were executing the policy from
yes.
London.
Yes, that's right, yes. I mean, I was a staff officer.
Mm.
But my boss was a chap called John Morg, and he was particularly interested in training.
Mm-hmm.
I used to rather annoy the BGS, a chap called Jackie Harmon. I got on with jolly well, but every now and again, the army commander would say, come up and see me, John. And I'd say, tell me what exercise you got on, and so on, and show great interest in that. And I had his ear to some extent.
I was and still remain a great, and I'm sure you agree with me, the value of well-run battlefield tours.
Of course.
And I said, I think we ought to do more of these. I said, a lot of younger chaps now don't know. They only read Monty's memoirs where everything just went. And I said, I think it's jolly good to go out and with DS and tell them about the fog of war and what happens when your soldiers start running away and what really happens there. Anyway, I sold this to him, so he said, that's all right. So he got a lot of money, and we did a lot of battlefield tours, which I was the sort of driving force.
Well, why did this upset Jackie Harmon? What?
Only because, you see, the chain of command was from me, as
yes.
Colonel Fane, through the BGS.
Yes.
To the Army Commander, and he felt, in a way, that he ought to be aware of what the Army Commander was telling me, because he was my boss.
Anyway, so he felt he was being bypassed?
Well, he's always been bypassed. Mm. Well, he did to start with, but I got on with Jackie Harmon very well.
Mm.
And so I always made a point, if I was, he wouldn't necessarily know, saying that, you know, next time I think you all know the Army Commander sent for me and he discussed this, and this is the sort of line he took with. But I didn't want to overplay that, but I would feel exactly the same, actually.
Mm.
He didn't forbid me, he couldn't.
Did you have direct contact with the planner so that you were aware of what sort of...
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, were there any areas to which they were assigning a particularly high priority at that time
no.
as potential for
no.
operations?
But then, you see, I went there in January...
January
1968.
Yes.
Then in the summer of 69, Northern Ireland
blew up. Yes.
So things changed then a bit, and gradually, 69 and 70, we began more. That became the main operational requirement. And again, I had to give thought. We started under my auspices. We started this first sort of. IRA village place down at Hythe and putting people and the concept of putting battalions through preliminary training before they went off to Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland training.
Yes,
NITAC. You set that up?
Yes.
Where did you get the idea for doing that? Was it...
Well, I think somebody said to you, I can't pretend it was... I was the first person to think of it, but I was the first person perhaps realise the importance of it.
Mm-hmm. What were the priorities for that? Did you have any... I mean, there's so many different things required, the ability to exert crowd control, dealing
well,
with...
Well, the first thing was...
Snipers, all sorts of...
The first thing I used to try and get some sort of doctrine out of Northern Ireland.
Yes, what, from Northern Ireland Command?
Yeah, Northern Ireland Command. And that's how we had to say. I got a team of quite good people together. I think we sent them over there to talk to them and say, look, what do you think? What particular points of specialised training would you want battalions coming? It had to be, obviously, one was playing it empirically.
What did they say? Do you remember what the reply was to your request?
Well, they welcomed the idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, they cooperated fully. But then they had to keep on amending it because the priorities in Northern Ireland. It was Belfast, sometimes it was Londonderry, sometimes it was South Armagh. Certainly Londonderry and Belfast were much the same, but when operations out in the country, South Armagh were very different. To some extent, I seem to think we began to start modifying the training to bring them to where the battalion was going. But then this was an ongoing business because the way the army operated in Northern Ireland began to change. So that was in aid of the police, and therefore you concentrated originally on sort of crowd control and helmets and that sort of thing. But then gradually it became much more operational. Yes. Therefore, you had to keep on adapting to the technical situation. Yeah. So it wasn't. It was like a sort of bar of soap. Once you've just gripped it, it sort of slipped down your hand.
When you first started,
It was mostly envisaged then. I seem to remember a sort of crowd control backing up the chaps with sort of shields and things like that. Mm. But that's how it started. Mm. There wasn't very much sniping of soldiers and that thing to start with. It was mostly sort of dealing with the angry crowds.
What did you look to for your basis for training on that in that sort of technique? Were you looking back to India, to crowd control India, or to Palestine, or to other historical examples?
Well, I had never
examples
of that particular aspect of internal security. But there was quite a lot of ex-policemen and people around, and it wasn't difficult to. Mm. I mean, the important thing was to get the right sort of chaps, pick the right people, tell them what. I mean, I didn't sit down with them and say this and that. I said, look, here, you are an ITAD. This is your role to go and find out from Northern Ireland what skills they particularly want their reinforcement battalions trained in. And you go over there, find that out, and then work out a doctrine, produce your own sort of training manuals, and get on with it. And if you want any backup or help from me, any equipment, or anything, come to me. So I didn't actually myself sit down and sort of write the doctrine. That wasn't my job.
You weren't exerting direct control.
It wasn't my job actually to write the training pamphlet for that. That it was such a movable thing, provided that they produced what Northern Ireland wanted. I reckon that was what I was fulfilling the job that was wanted. Mm. So I was really a sort of broker in a sense.
It sounds more as though you were allocating the right men to the right jobs than actually doing direct management of what they were doing.
I know. Yes.
Well, in a way, that's rather similar to what you were doing at MS. Concerned with making sure you've got the right men in the right appointments, performing the right functions.
Well, yes, because I suppose that's true. Yes,
it's on a different level, on a different scale,
yes.
A different purpose.
But then the whole of personnel work is that, isn't it? Mm. I mean, personnel managers don't train people. They select people with certain qualities to put round pegs in round holes and make sure you don't put too many square things, that's all. I mean, I hadn't got the time to sit down and start writing a training pamphlet for Northern Ireland. Mm. I had about 16 or 17, it was a huge branch. So all I could do was make sure I got good officers, tell them clearly what I wanted of them, and let them get on with it, judge them by results. I mean, that's all. I reckon that's the way to run any organisation, actually. Mm. I don't think you want to start, trying to sort of cite the Bren guns. I think, as long as you've got the right chaps, it works.
But was this work a work which kept you primarily in the headquarters and in your office, or was it a post?
Well, I mean, I was a staff officer there, yeah, but at the same time...
Well, could you get out and about?
I got out a lot, because the brigade, we're very keen to find new training areas.
Yes.
So, that was the first thing. So, I was sent